The following program is for informational and educational purposes only. This program does not replace medical, mental health, or psychological diagnosis and treatment prescribed by your personal physician, psychologist, therapist, or other healthcare provider. Please consult your provider for diagnosis and care before beginning or changing any program or idea discussed.
Welcome to Psych Up Live with your host, Dr. Suzanne Phillips. This is the show that brings you a psychological perspective on common and current life issues. Here is Dr. Suzanne Phillips.
Welcome. I'm Suzanne Phillips. Thanks for joining me again on Psych Up Live. We witness worldwide devastation from war, natural disasters, epidemics, violence, social and racial injustice. We are victims, bystanders, and responders, often struggling to cope, wanting to help, but not certain what to do or how to sustain. In this show, you're going to hear of the steps taken by Gay Logan, a British-American psychoanalyst and group therapist with a dream to train and support caregivers in the Ukraine. What Gay Logan offers is valuable for everyone to hear, as she maintains that caregivers need to pass forward the very skills and emotional survival strategies they use to keep on caring. She recognizes that when parents and caregivers have the means to remain calm in adversity, they are able to support their own and their child or patient's nervous system. It is the benefit of co-regulation, and its applicability is life-saving. Gay Logan is a British-American psychoanalyst, group therapist, clinical supervisor, and author. She is the USA Executive Director of the International Institute for Trauma Studies in Vincennes, Ukraine. She is a fellow of the American Group Psychotherapy Association and a graduate of Harvard Medical School's Global Mental Health Program. Her evidence-based protocol, contemplative-based trauma and resiliency training, has been implemented in UN outreach throughout the Middle East, Lebanon, Turkey, Uganda, Ukraine, and the U.S. In recognition of the clinical excellence and humanitarian outreach, Gay Logan is a recipient of the International Dialogue and Peace Award, the Four Corners Group Psychotherapy Society's Visionary Leader Award, and the American Group Psychotherapy Association's Social Responsibility Award. We are so fortunate to have her. Gay Logan, it is my privilege to welcome you back to Psych Up Live.
Oh, Suzanne, it is. I'm so honored and humbled to be here and be here with you again. Thank you for having me. I was just saying the break before we started that my experience of being interviewed by you is always so powerful and so warm, because I have this sense that you actually, you know, did your homework. You really kind of researched what I'm doing and probably what everybody else is doing that you interview, in such a way that the questioning that emerges in the dialogue between us just is so salient. And I love the way you're masterful at that. So thank you, Suzanne, for having me here.
Oh, thank you. So, Gay, in your work, one of the things you say is that to heal, we need to strengthen the capacity to bear witness, to name and respond to the suffering of the other, as well as our own. Now, I know you have been doing that throughout your entire life's work. Mm-hmm. Now, even back to earlier veterans, before you responded to the Ukraine, tell us a little bit about that momentum that you propose for healing.
Well, I'll tell you a short story about how I somehow ended up in this pathway to really study trauma and to study healing. It's really, you can't really study trauma without really wondering about what is it to heal. And you can't really provide anything that sort of satisfies what is needed in healing without understanding trauma. So this process started for me many years ago. I think I was 25 or maybe 26. And I was either still in grad school or just coming out of grad school. I was still in grad school. And it was a year before PTSD was actually admitted to the DSM. For those of you who are not clinicians, it's a kind of diagnostic statistical manual that kind of lays out all the different diagnoses and the eligibility or the characteristics of that diagnosis. And so prior to that, we didn't have the word PTSD, if you can imagine that. And so people that went off to war for generations, including World War One and Two and the Crimean War and the maybe the Spanish Civil War, I mean, like, you know, wars within the last 150 years, they came back from the front lines. Often there was no news, except for maybe originally there was some news in Crimea. But the news would always be delayed, and the vets were gone for a long time. And when they came back, they were very altered. And it was called war neurosis, war shock, you know, as if anybody could ever not be impacted by war. And to actually say that you've got a neurosis because you have trouble after war is sort of wildly insensitive to what we didn't understand. And so early on in 1979, I got asked to lead a 2-year pilot study group for American vets. They were Tet Offensive vets who saw probably the worst of the combat during the Vietnam War, when the Vietnamese called the American War. And I was a woman with who was actually a peace activist, who was very young and very undertrained, with a big job, with a co-therapist who wasn't the therapist, but was a long-range reconnaissance patrolman. And they just, for the first 6 months of this 2-year group, they just didn't even make eye contact with me. And really, they'd never told these stories to a woman, to their daughters, to their mothers, to their sisters, to their girlfriends, to their wives. Because these stories were too horrific. And they carried shame, and they carried moral injury, and they carried, you know, enough content to have still 10 years out nightmares. But they come look at me. And then I had a miscarriage. I was out of the group for a few weeks. My co-therapist, who wasn't really trained as a therapist, then announced to the group that I'd had a miscarriage, which normally you wouldn't do. So I came back, and they all knew I'd had a miscarriage, and they just started talking to me. It was like my own suffering was the price of admission. Uh-huh. And they said, what did you notice while we froze you out? And I said, well, you wouldn't make eye contact with me. So I kept my eyes kind of focused on the pattern of the Oriental carpet on the floor. And they said, well, what did you notice about that? And I said, well, what I actually noticed was that you're all wearing combat boots, Army dispatch combat boots, 10 years after you came home from Vietnam, wow. But you haven't come home. Mm-hmm. And then we began to work.
Wow. Precious. You know, it makes they were not ready to take off symbolically the boots because they had never told their stories. You and I talk about narrating healing, putting words to the unthinkable. And that was the opening. When you were someone who had shared your suffering, as you say, they dared to get close.
Yes, it's so beautifully said, Suzanne. And then they began to do the work in the group of what their experiences were. And some of them were, you know, quite horrific. I no need to share the graphic details. But one by one, they began to wear different footwear.
I love it.
One by one, they were wearing Birkenstocks and, you know, flip-flops and Nike, you know, and Converse high tops and whatever, you know. And it became a joke in the group. Who's gonna change their shoes now?
So now did this prepare you or even prompt you to consider, what can I do? What was it that you found in Ukraine? Because you've done tremendous amounts of international work. What was it that prompted you to feel, I have to step up in Ukraine?
Yeah, so fast forward, right? So fast forward, I'm trained as a psychoanalyst. I'm a very long time practicing Buddhist. I seem to keep doing these things, engaging in these trainings that, you know, awaken a certain sensitivity to suffering and to the alleviation of suffering, as the Buddhists would say. And so I had given a trauma training with a colleague of mine. I was invited to Istanbul in the summer of 2019, but before COVID. And it was a very wonderful training. I loved the 85 members of the group that were all Turkish. Well, some were Egyptian, but it was a really profound group. And the psychiatrist who had invited me was the chair of Trauma and Disaster for International Association for Group Psychotherapy. And he was getting more involved with this small a PhD program in Vinnytsia, Ukraine, as kind of an advisor. And so he asked me after this training if I would be willing to be an advisor, an advisory council for this university. And I said, sure. And then kind of promptly, you know, COVID hit, and I was still kind of very involved with so many other training projects and my own private practice that I didn't do much. I mean, I really did nothing. I was somehow placed in the position to be able to do something, even if I was dormant at that moment. Mm-hmm. And in the December of 2021, there was a lot of, will Putin invade? Will he not invade Ukraine? You know, is he just saber rattling, or is he going to actually do something? And I just had this instinct that he was going to invade. It was not a matter of if, it was a matter of what, when. And I took the contemplative-based trauma and resiliency training that I had developed over many years, which kind of teaches neuroscience and contemplative practices. And I had the foresight to think that if a war started, there would be a huge diaspora through Poland, and probably a diaspora that would include Russians that didn't want to be involved with the war, and maybe Russian men that didn't want to be conscripted. And so I reached out on Facebook, actually, to try to find Ukrainian psychologists who spoke English. And then I reached out to the State Department to translate my protocols into Russian, Polish, and Ukrainian. And I received the protocols translated into Ukrainian back on February 23rd, 2022, and Putin invaded on the 24th.
Wow. Wow.
So I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
I had the organizational support of the International Association for Group Psychotherapy. And then I had, you know, so many colleagues, dear colleagues over the years. We share some colleagues in common that I knew I could tap and say, hey. And so I started with my training, you know, this kind of understanding the brain's emergency circuitry, understanding a sort of new paradigm of trauma, that trauma is really not about the incident so much. It's about the nervous system and the body's capacity to reliably re-regulate after a massive perception of threat. And so I taught that. And then I got a colleague, my dear colleague, who has written a lot with me, Patricia Tolleson, who's also a group therapist. And I asked her to teach our parent-child program, because we had also developed a kind of a child program, going back to a book we'd co-authored on self-regulation for kids. I asked her to teach that. And the reason I was concerned about that content being shared was, with war, as we know, there is always the risk of the massive assault on the civilian population. And in fact, in the 1900s was when in warfare when attacks on civilians became sort of war strategy. It really wasn't prior to that. So what you end up then with is this tremendous risk for multi-generational trauma.
So let me just stop you here to ask, because we have out listening to you folks who've faced mass trauma at a parade when there's a shooting. We have people just dealing with the natural disaster in Florida with the hurricanes, and we have little ones involved. So give us an example of the kind of intervention for children in terms of regulation in the aftermath of what it doesn't even make sense to adults. So what are the little ones really going to do?
Yeah. Well, you know, we have some protocols that would be sort of do's and don'ts with little ones and also big ones.
Yes.
Not really that different. Because those big ones have little ones inside them.
Yep.
But like, for example, you want to be able to stay in the here and now. You want to bring the children and the adults' attention to come into the here and now, to not get reiterating the graphic details of maybe what just happened or what they witnessed, but to really stay with feelings and to not project into the future the enormous loss of absolutisms that kind of translates into a feeling of uncertainty and instability. So you want to kind of keep everybody a little bit more contained in the here and now. You want to teach them really simple somatic anchors, like let's take three breaths. If we count our inhale to five, let's count our exhale to seven. Let's feel our feet on the ground. Let's find sensations. Let's feel the feet connected to the earth and to the roots that go into the earth. And I do this for adults like all week long in Ukraine. So, and then, you know, let's wiggle our toes. So you want to kind of do these fundamentally mindfulness exercises that are based on developing awareness of sensation and coming into the present moment. And that process, from a neurobiological perspective, is calming. It's down-regulating. It engages the parasympathetic nervous system, which is what we want, because the sympathetic nervous system activates into fight, flight, and freeze. Mm-hmm. And the parasympathetic kind of down-regulates. So you want to help kids and grown-ups find a way to keep working on their calm. You want to make sure that graphic details aren't shared. You want to make sure that you stick with simple answers about what we know today, what we're going to do today. Kids that's after an acute crisis with kids, but you know, it's a whole different story really when you get into a war that's gone on for, you know, 2.5 years. In those cases, you know, a lot of our methodology, one of the classes we teach, just one of them, is to really teach these practices to parents, to teachers, to child psychiatrists, to teach these practices to clinicians, whether they're working with children or parents or combatants or, you know, otherwise civilians, right? The ability to keep in little moments all through the day, strengthen the muscle for calming. Because what some of the research would suggest about PTSD is that, you know, a catastrophic event does not make PTSD inevitable.
Right.
It's really the quality of the capacity to face it with a kind of capacity for calm that allows the whole nervous system not to get sort of the arousal system to kind of get so escalated with mobilization in the limbic system that it can't then back down or doesn't know how to back down, come down to kind of a baseline again. So we that's a huge part of. We did a training for staff, social workers, and camp counselors of an orphan camp up in the Ukrainian mountains over the summer for 300 orphans. And we just worked with the camp counselors and the psychologists and the social workers and the school counselors, right? And what our program, I mean, I can come back maybe and tell a little bit more about the full scope of the program, but this sort of starting with a meditative, easy somatic anchor, and then I do teach longer meditations that include cultivating a sense of inner sanctuary, cultivating a kind of embodied mindful awareness, cultivating compassion, compassion for the self, compassion for the stranger. These compassion meditations were used in Tibetan monasteries for thousands of years and have been kind of secularized and then taught at Stanford in the Translational Neuroscience Department. I mean, so you start out with self-compassion, not because that's how they did it in the monasteries, but because that's how the American neuroscientists have to explain to His Holiness the Dalai Lama that in this culture, you actually have to start with self-compassion. So to do that, and then to sort of compassion for a stranger, compassion for a loved one, compassion for a difficult other, all the way up to even imagining compassion for an enemy. That's a very hard sell with a country in wartime.
Yeah.
And so I don't push on that. Then there's sort of compassion for just sort of our whole suffering world, you know, our all beings.
One of the things that you're letting us know that's so powerful is whether it's a 10-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 50-year-old, when you have a tool that you can draw upon, self-compassion, the kind of compassion, the anchoring, that actually fuels a sense of resilience, a sense of efficacy in the face of what Gaby called before, it's the trampling of absolutisms, that I'm safe, that I'll always be safe, that mommy will always be here, and that we'll always have our house. What trauma does is trample those.
It shatters it entirely, yeah.
So we need a way for the person to feel some sense of efficacy, some sense of there's something I can do. It sounds small, but when people are able to do it, it's very powerful.
It's very powerful. And last year in my class, I had a student, my classes are very large, but I had a student who is a clinician. My students are graduate students or clinicians in the larger Ukrainian landscape, military psychologists, psychiatrists, school psychologists, some very experienced. You know, so Oksana was in my contemplative-based trauma and resiliency class, and she raised her hand last year, and she said, early on in the class, she said, "Can I teach this to my grandmother?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely. I want you to teach it to whoever you see every day. You know, like you can teach it to kids, you can teach it to your grandmother, you can teach it, and you can teach it to your patients. But you can teach it better to everybody if you do these practices regularly. We have to, it's a first person methodology. We have to start with ourselves. You can't just like say, oh, just be calm. You know, you actually have to be calm to convey calm. So we say calm creates calm, right?
Yes. You know, you're mentioning different generations. And one of the things you wrote, Gay, was that when you went in your response to the Ukraine, there is so much shared trauma. There's a grandmother, a psychiatrist, a baby. Everyone's in the bomb shelter.
Yeah.
I mean, so from that reality of shared trauma, what unfolds in terms of how you help them, or what triggered you into programs or methods?
Yeah, I think we're almost at the break, right? Maybe we'll take the break and come back. I noticed that our dear engineer said you get 4 minutes, and I think we're done.
She's a good timekeeper for me.
Yes.
Okay, folks.
So why don't we come back with that wonderful question, and I'll talk a little bit more about the curriculum and the program and how each class kind of layers onto the other.
Okay. At Gay's suggestion, we're going to take a brief break. You're listening to Psych Up Live, and we're speaking to Gay. You hear how wonderful she is. And she's the USA Executive Director of the International Institute for Trauma Studies in Vinnytsia, Ukraine. She's sharing the powerful program and actually gay sharing methods that she has perfected and treasured over years of working with this kind of outreach. We're so happy to have her. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Follow Voice America at facebook.com/Voice America for juicy updates from your favorite radio shows and podcasts. Psych Up Live with host Dr. Suzanne Phillips offers a psychological perspective on coping with common and current life issues. This show addresses topics as varied as marital stress, insomnia, depression, raising teens, campus violence, and building self-resilience. Listen in as Dr. Phillips and her guest experts share the latest in books, findings, and information that will inform and enhance your life journey. Psych Up Live is heard every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Tune in to the Voice America Variety Channel on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Voice America Variety broadcasts a diverse array of topics, reaching a global community. Our experts come from all walks of life, and the topics they discuss are everything from current events, arts and entertainment, leadership, parenting, relationships, self-improvement, career advice, and a variety of other topics. Check us out today. You're sure to find something of interest. Voice America Variety. Talk on today's hot topics.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Psych Up Live. Join in our conversation today. Send an email to radiohostphillips@gmail.com. Now, back to Psych Up Live.
Welcome back to Psych Up Live. We're here, as you know, with Gay Logan, British American psychoanalyst, who's done an incredible amount of outreach over many, many years. She's going to continue to share some of the techniques and some of the wisdom from being someone who's really responded to international crisis. So, Gay, let's talk about some of the actual programs that, as you mentioned, you offered them at Harvard, but you then took them to the Ukraine. Let's mention some of the programs, methods, and strategies that have been really viable in the aftermath of war and disaster.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a big question. I have this huge program in Ukraine, and yesterday was on a long call with this Israeli psychiatrist and two psychotherapists, and they wanted to, kind of bring me in to consult with some of what they're trying to do. And I've also done a lot of work with Palestinians, but as a sort of a larger other question. What I want to go back to is when I was talking earlier about, somehow being miraculously prepared with curriculum, like the day before Putin invaded, with everything translated into Russian, Polish, and Ukraine. So we started just with this contemplative class and then the adaptation for parents and children. And then I got the idea, what if I committed a year to Ukraine and did a monthly lecture series on all kinds of topics, shame, addiction, migration trauma, just like, all kinds of things. And I know and love so many colleagues around the world that it was easy for me to pick up the phone and say, hey, can I tap you to come share your work with my lecture series? And I also had the support of the International Association for Group Psychotherapy, who then gave me that award. Then I got to the end of that year into the war. I gave a plenary speech for the Ukraine psychoanalytic. Well, you know, we kept thinking it would be over, it would be over, it would be over. Got to the end of that year, and I knew that what we had done, although it was wonderful, it was just a drop in a bucket. I mean, it was just nowhere near enough. So I spoke to some of the Ukrainian faculty from the university that I had previously been invited to be an advisor to this university in Ukraine. I spoke to the dean and the psychology lead faculty, and I said, look, I had this idea in the shower. It actually came from a dream. What if we do a certification program for graduate students and all of Ukrainian kind of mental health workers from all different disciplines, like a one-year training program, and we keep the lecture series going, but we have six courses in the areas of combat trauma, communal trauma, and psychedelic assisted. Now, this was kind of a wild and bold thing to do in a somewhat conservative country, to have a state university sponsor my decision.
What a great idea to pass forward the expertise so they could pick it up on their own. I love that.
Yeah, and also to do an intro class that didn't actually train them in psychedelic medicine, but brought up issues of, you know, spirituality and ethics and set and setting and the efficacy research and states of change of mind and the reduction of the narrative identity that holds the story of the trauma in place. All the things that are possible with psychedelic medicine, kind of linking well with the contemplative-based stuff.
Okay.
I pitched this idea, this crazy idea they were my students at the time. And they said, sure, you know, sounds good. Why don't we talk to the president of the university? So that was like June 15th, a year and change ago. And she said, yes, total green light, start September 4th. So I had 6 weeks to put together a year-long training program.
Okay.
And so, you know, we did. And four courses, combat trauma, psychedelic assisted.
So stop for a minute, Gay, and because they're all wondering, give us an example of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. Just give us an example so they know what we're saying.
Okay, so, you know, legislation is being passed in the U.S. and somewhat stalled, but in terms of psilocybin, MDMA, and ketamine. Ketamine was being already used in Ukraine and used with combatants. And my colleague now is doing a clinical trial on working with different categories of combatants that are on the front lines, demobilized, and those who were on the front lines, had some traumatic experience, and want to go back. So what the psychedelic experience can offer is a kind of impact on the nervous system that allows a different kind of understanding to emerge out of the graphic details or the narrative identity of a story, so that there's actually more freedom in the psyche and there is more ability to return to normal functioning.
So in other words, just correct me on this, it enhance the ability to stay calmer as you recollect the horror?
Yeah, and it opens up other kinds of internal freedoms that allow a person to see what happened and not be so identified with the catastrophe of it.
Okay.
Right? So, and each medicine does something relatively different. We're not teaching psychedelic assisted this year because MDMA wasn't approved by the U.S. and I don't want to.
Okay. So
you know, it's really an interesting thing. And that was actually what the Israelis were coming to me about, was they were trying to do a ketamine-assisted training retreat for their soldiers.
Okay, so now let me ask about communal trauma, because mm-hmm. that's what we have here. We have it in Israel. Where whole communities, you know, are devastated by, whether it's a shooter. Look at Uvalde. I mean, mm-hmm. how many children? So what do you mean when you talk about communal trauma? What kind of strategies address that?
So, you know, we try very hard to bring resilience, training, and new skills and new understandings about how to work with trauma to our graduate students and our the existing psychologists in the field, with the understanding that each of those, there is not a person in Ukraine who hasn't lost someone. There is not a person in Ukraine who hasn't lost someone.
Yes, I'm hearing it. There's not a person who hasn't lost someone. Got it.
Yeah. It's like an old Buddhist story of the mustard seed, but it's quite, so, you know, you have to say, okay, how do we support the clinicians to have the skills they need and the internal, almost like post-traumatic growth kinds of skills that they might need inside themselves, like Donna Orange, wonderful psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, sorry, talks about nourishing the inner life of humanitarian aid workers and clinicians. This idea that they have to be resourced or they will just crash and burn. Mm-hmm. The burn factor is so high. And what our first year of training, which ended last May, June, we had reached 2,072 graduate students and Ukrainian clinicians.
Oh, gives me a chill. That's wonderful. Yeah.
And at the end, they were saying, now I feel like I have hope. Now I feel like I know how to help my country. Now I feel like I can help my family. Now I feel like I can work with children in a new way. Now I feel like I know how to prevent burnout. Now I feel like I can maintain hope while everything seems not so hopeful. Right. Mm-hmm.
So give us an example of one of the skills, in, just as an example, so our listeners can grab it.
Well, we talked about the mindfulness practices and the compassion practices. I want to also give a nod to one of the founders of my psychoanalytic institute, Robert Stolaro, American psychoanalyst, who had the experience of his beloved wife and co-author being diagnosed with a rough lung cancer, they're being prepared for treatment. And him waking up in the morning, she was dead beside him. And it shattered him, just absolutely shattered him. And he kind of went back to the psychologist, psychoanalyst. He went back and got a PhD in philosophy. And he wrote a beautiful book called Trauma and Human Existence. There was some very simple and basic concepts that are fundamental in our program. So I want to talk to those concepts. And Suzanne actually already mentioned the loss of absolutisms. So how do you, with the shared trauma piece, here's a clinician who may have lost their son and who is working with young soldiers and working with parents and working with widows. That's shared trauma.
Yes.
Because the widows are experiencing something. The parents are experiencing something. The combatants are experiencing something. Sometimes they're all in the same bomb shelter under the same missile attack, right? This is not like somebody comes into your office and they were sexually abused as a child, which is a horrific thing. But it is, I was not sexually abused as a child. I'm not living under the same missiles, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So how do you really prepare the clinician to be able to bear and to tolerate the suffering of the other as well as themselves, which is how we started, right?
We said, yes.
And one of the ways, you know, to sort of be able to name the loss of absolutisms. Bob Stolaro tells about how people tried to come over and he said, blow smoke up their asses, his ass, because trying to pretty it up or make it nice when his best friend then came over and said, "You're a shattered, destroyed man." And he was like, "Oh, finally, somebody understands," right? Mm-hmm. And so being able to tolerate, being able to not dance around, to not deny, but also to not, to hold hope at the same time. So one of the places where we convey hope is through connection, relational connection. Another concept from Bob or from, you know, relational psychoanalysis is what Bob talked about, the creating a relational home. Mm-hmm. Every time I teach a class, I may have 400 people on the call. I may have 60 people. I'm always saying, look, we're a community. Look around, see who we are. Put your video on. Don't just, you know, be on your phone. And sometimes people have to be on their phone because they have limited electricity, right? Mm-hmm. Let's look at who's here. Let's raise our hands. Let's talk. Let's build on each other's conversation. Let's create a relational home that gives us a kind of secure attachment in a sense to tolerate the suffering and the uncertainty.
One thing he says in that supports this is he calls that a dwelling place.
A dwelling, to dwell within that relational home.
The other thing that I want our people to hear is that pain is not pathology.
Yeah.
You know, that people feel, there's a feeling of embarrassment and humiliation sometimes when a horrendous event has happened to you.
Shame.
Yes, yes. So that when you are with people who are sharing it, mm-hmm. freely, that mm-hmm. the dynamic shifts.
Yeah, and you know, to tap Stolaro, our beloved Stolaro, once again, he also talked of a concept that I think is very salient, and he called it siblings in the dark.
Yes, I love it. Okay.
You know, that sense that, okay, we're in this together. And that has been, when I say, you know, people get to the end of our year of training, you know, and people are finding resilience and hope that they never imagined they could have given the context. So much of it, it's about all of this. But it's as much about the sense of relational home and indwelling in that home that we can co-create and sense that we're not isolated, yes. that I can actually tell you how terrified I am, you know. But I can also tell you that I had a popsicle, you know, with a friend the other day, and, you know, we were kind of happy that the bombs weren't dropping, you know.
I'm sure you've had this experience, too, where first responders hesitate to share much of anything. Mm-hmm. But in one group, and I mentioned this in another show, no one was speaking. Everybody's hands were forward, crossed across their chests, and one man started to speak. Mm-hmm. And someone said, "What he said is what I feel."
Good.
I said, "That's what I feel." And so that was it. That opened that door.
There it was. Yeah. There it was. And, you know, we had a dear mentor, both of us, I'm sure, at our affiliation with the American Group Psychotherapy Association, Yvonne Agazarian, would teach us about creating, you know, functional subgroups. We're in this together with the feelings that we have, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that really resonates with little ones, whether you are all holding puppets or yeah. whether you are all singing. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of shared safety, shared psychological safety is so important.
Yeah, some really very touching comments that come back from our students that are working with kids, and also our child psychiatrist. You know, my translator is actually a child psychiatrist. I love her so much. Her name is Olha Serha. I'm shouting out to her now, wherever she is.
She's okay, good.
But she's always working with kids, and she uses these practices with them. And she just sees them kind of calm immediately just by doing the practices. But I think another thing that has been wildly, you know, maybe understated, we built a program. I mean, call me crazy, but we built a program in the middle of war, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I kept saying to my donors, listen, you know, I don't need you to put any money into the actual bricks and mortar because that might be down the tubes. But we do most everything online, and we'd still need, we're opening a clinic. Actually, we're working on opening a clinic. I'm trying to see if we can get a big USAID grant.
The clinic is going to be a family clinic. And then all of our graduates will work in the clinic and get additional supervision. So that's sort of another aspect of what we're doing. So what I'm saying is there is something that talks to go back to your point of, about agency with being able to do the meditation practices, right? There's an agency. When I would interview in the Tibetan exiled health ministry, I did a big trauma training there. And I interviewed a lot of different aspects of the population, including Buddhist nuns who had been sexually tortured by the Chinese, by their guards when they were in prison. And I asked them, what did they use at the time in which they were being tortured to hold on to their minds and to not collapse? Because Tibetans actually, on the Harvard scales, they show very much less PTSD. They have higher incidences of gastrointestinal problems, but less PTSD. And all of them said, well, we use compassion practice. We imagine having compassion for the guard that was doing it, which is a wildly radical, that's a radical ethic if you think about it. But what it did for their nervous systems was it gave them something to do and it calmed them, right? Mm-hmm. So those compassion practices are actually in what we teach. So it was interesting for me to hear that one of the ways that they survived was by doing teaching.
You know,
another story about building,
a show on spirit, on resilience, one of the things they said is almost nothing describing the Hanoi Hilton and the way Vietnam vets were tortured overlooks the fact that spirituality was the main source of resilience and connection with each other. And so you're saying a very similar thing.
I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm also saying that the practice of compassion is a shared responsibility.
So translate that.
That we have an obligation as humans to care about each other. Independent of nationality, race, gender, religion, political party. And we actually have to think more about extending compassion to people who are quite different from us and may even be our enemies. But I think also, in situations like this, the compassion for an enemy may be, like PhD level compassion, but we have to start with compassion for ourselves as Westerners, maybe not in the Tibetan community, but as Westerners, we do. And I want to go back to, so it is a shared responsibility and how we hold what we're experiencing, how we make sense of it, how we also have compassion for our own suffering. We can't really have real, genuine, rooted compassion for another if we don't know how to offer it to ourselves. We really can't. We're sort of faking it.
The hidden trauma is the one that can't get healed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the sharing of it is like somebody's holding half of it. And if we hold people in the group, now we're even doing better.
Oh, beautiful. I've been in conversations where I have heard, especially after not only in Ukraine, but I was brought in to do a large group after the Hamas attacks and 150 Israeli psychologists. I have heard stuff that I would never want to have to repeat because of the impact of on the listener. But to be able to hear it and be able to tolerate and bear my own nervous system so that I can hear it for the other actually helps move that trauma along.
Well, that's what beautifully said. Yeah. It's almost like you give yourself the compassionate resilience factor so you can hold and share.
And that's what I meant in the beginning when you kind of pulled out this comment, I think, from my paper about being able to tolerate the suffering to witness and tolerate the suffering of others and also ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go back to a building story that I love saying, because it was one of my Buddhist teachers who was a huge influence on my life.
Okay, we have 10 minutes, so we have time. Go ahead.
Good, wonderful.
Okay.
So it's going back to what I was saying about the energy that everybody has. Like, and they're in the middle of a war, working on developing this certification program, attending classes, really showing up for classes, showing up in the group discussions, in breakout rooms. This year, we were reached by the it's a program in Ukraine, in the All Ukraine Mental Health Program that is under the auspices of Madame Zelenska. She's very much an advocate for mental health. And the program is called How Are You? And so the regional director reached out to us and said, we love what you're doing. We didn't even reach out to them. They reached out to us and said, we love what you're doing. We want to promote you. We want to be, to collaborate with you. We want to be an affiliate. We want to use all of our promotional capacity to move out even more fully into the Ukrainian network, what you're doing, so more people have access. And we were so touched by that. It was like, we've just been busy working, building this thing. And they came to us. And that was so, to really be like, okay, you know, reached out to by this enormous program that's a national program and a very successful national program. So they wanted to collaborate with us. And the next thing, like almost the next week, I have my allies and my dear friends, as particularly a friend, Taras Levin, who's the co-director of the Ukrainian Association for Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis, APAPU. And I love, Taras is, lives in Kyiv, and he's, you know, he's right, Kyiv is much more bombarded by missile attack than Venezia. And he's always asking me to give a plenary speech. Last time I was asked to give one on the second anniversary of the Putin's invasion for their their annual conference. And so Taras reached out and said, hey, we want to collaborate with you. We want to be with you in this. We want to have our logos on the certifications for the graduates. You know, we really want to promote your work and really be collaborators. So, you know, from my perspective, what we've done in a very short period of time in the context of war is create community psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, Freud actually had a lot of ideas about it, but then didn't really implement it. And in fact, you know, it kind of didn't really validate the impact of the actual social environment on people's well-being.
In both directions. Yeah, you know, yeah. Get in for bad. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, he thought as if all the difficulties were like internal conflicts, right? And this sort of community psychoanalysis was really debunks that and really kind of takes on the whole sort of social frame that we all, it's a shared trauma that we're all living, whether we're talking about war or climate.
So I have to stop you because I want to make sure people know how to reach you.
Okay.
So I want to thank my listeners. Remember that you can hear this in any prior show as a podcast. This will be a podcast on October 31st, and then it will be actually available from that point on. But I want you to be able to read Gay's beautiful paper and reach her website, which you're going to find has a lot to offer you, just as she was such a gift to us today. So that website, give it to them if you would, Gay.
I'll give you both. I'll give you my personal email if you want to reach out to me, because you may want to reach out to me personally without having to go through, you know, all of our social media layers of colleagues and people that work with us in on the site. The website is icmhhr.org, icmhhr.org. And and that stands for International Center for Mental Health and Human Rights. And my email is gaylogan, G-A-E-A-L-O-G-A-N, at Gmail. Yeah. Gaylogan, G-A-E-A-L-O-G-A-N, at Gmail.
So Gay, how about giving us a take-home message? Because your wisdom is something people need to hold on to.
Take-home message will be a story from Thich Nhat Hanh, very quickly. In the Vietnam War, there was a village that was constantly being bombed down every day. Unfortunately, it was us that were doing it. It was bombed down. It was a very poor village. People lived in, you know, just kind of poles and banana leaf houses, huts. And it would be in flames and napalm and burned down every day. And every day, Thich Nhat Hanh, a very venerated Buddhist monk, would go into the village with his students and rebuild for the villagers there, with the villagers and for the villagers, their huts. And the next week it would be burned down again. And the next week he would go in again with his students and his disciples and build with the villagers, build the village up again. And this actually happened 7 times. Bombed down, built back, bombed down, built back, bombed down. And someone asked him, this is kind of a stupid, futile thing that you got going here. What are you doing? I mean, it's, there's no point in doing this. And he said, without the building, there is no hope.
It's perfect. I want to thank you again, Gay, for coming on. You're always a gift to our listeners. And I want to remind our listeners, until next week, be safe, thanks, and be listening.
Thank you for tuning in to Psych Up Live. Please join Dr. Suzanne Phillips for another edition of our programming next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Until then, be well and be listening.